This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Tuesday, after weeks of pressure, Queensland eases some border restrictions with New South Wales, as does South Australia. Could this mean the country is heading back to some sense of normality? And the federal government puts out its plan for a low emissions future. Will it work, or is it a roadmap to nowhere?
The world is moving towards decarbonisation at a million miles an hour. The world and major leading corporates, major leading financial institutions are focused on decarbonisation, and yet our government is absolutely focused on propping up the gas industry at every turn using taxpayer subsidies.
Well, we start today with some good news on COVID-19. For the first time in 106 days, New South Wales has not recorded any new locally acquired cases. And on the border front, there's good news too. We'll hear about Queensland in a moment. We begin in South Australia, which has announced that from midnight tomorrow night, it's opening up to New South Wales for the first time in months. That's as long as health authorities don't detect any community transmission in New South Wales between now and then. For more, I was joined a short time ago by South Australian state political reporter Isabel Damon in Adelaide.
Well, Sally, we've heard that after many, many months, I think since March, the South Australian border is going to reopen to New South Wales. Now, that will take effect from midnight tomorrow. So essentially from Thursday, anybody who's entering South Australia from New South Wales will no longer have to complete that mandatory 14 days of quarantine. So that's really been what's been standing in the way of free travel between the two states. We had last week the ACT border open up with South Australia again. So that really signalled the first step that this might be on the way. But really an announcement today that so many people have been waiting for, particularly border communities like Broken Hill, this news will be coming as a huge relief to them today. The Premier says that South Australia couldn't rush this. It can't risk having a second wave, but he is confident this is the right decision going forward. Here's a little bit of what he had to say earlier.
That means that people from New South Wales wanting to come into South Australia from Thursday onwards will be able to do that without doing the 14 days of self-isolation. So this will be a massive, massive relief to people who have been dislocated from friends, from family, from business opportunities. This will be a huge relief.
That's the South Australian Premier, Stephen Marshall. Isabel, give us a bit of a sense of the politics and the mood in South Australia. Business and some border communities and some families have been pushing for the border to open, but others have been very concerned about the possible spread of COVID in South Australia, particularly given an ageing population in some parts of the state. How difficult has it been for the government to balance those competing interests?
Yeah, look, it has been an extremely difficult balancing act the entire way through. South Australia, really from the beginning of the pandemic, when things started to feel like they were getting a little bit out of control in Australia in that time around February, March, South Australia really took a conservative approach right from the beginning. The mantra the whole way through has been public health has to be the number one consideration. But of course, as we've had no active cases here, I think for more than a week now, and as we've seen cases dropping into state, people are really starting to feel that the economy needs to get a bit of a boost and that we need that travel coming in and out. Tourism is a huge industry in South Australia, a really important industry. So there's been a lot of noise on both sides coming at the state government. Certainly a lot of people feeling like this decision is timely now and one that had to happen sooner or later. So I'm sure there still will be people who are concerned about those health risks. But as we've heard, the public health officials really do think now is the right time and this is a safe decision.
That's South Australian state political reporter for the ABC, Isabel Damon in Adelaide. And the good COVID result in New South Wales has also prompted Queensland to ease its border controls. Queensland's been under sustained pressure to open its border, and it's now lifting restrictions on five local government areas in New South Wales. The Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk has announced that from October the 1st, residents in Byron Bay, Ballina, Lismore, Richmond Valley and Glen Innes local government areas will be able to travel to Queensland.
So they will come in on 1 a.m. on the 1st of October. So residents will be able to apply for a border pass and then they will be able to freely travel around Queensland, and Queenslanders will also be able to travel there as well.
That's the Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk. Well, moving on now, and after more than a decade of energy policy paralysis, the federal government has unveiled its plan to guide billions of taxpayer dollars into new low emissions technologies. The so-called Technology Investment Roadmap is being launched today. It touts hydrogen, carbon capture and green steelmaking as the future planks of a low carbon economy. While experts say some of the technologies show real promise, they argue that the plan is meaningless unless the government sets a clear emissions target by 2050. Gavin Coote begins our coverage.
After years of fractious energy debate, the Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, is now spelling out the technologies that he believes have the most promise to achieve a low emissions future. The plan being unveiled today puts hydrogen, carbon capture and low-carbon steel and aluminium right up the top of the priority list.
He very definitely is focusing on technologies which might solve a problem, might in the future.
That's Greg Bourne, a councillor with the Climate Council, who's worked in the energy business for 30 years, including as a boss with BP and special advisor to the Thatcher UK government. He's been closely watching the development of the energy plan, which the Morrison government argues will use technology, not taxes, to cut emissions and create jobs, and sets the scene for next year's global climate talks in Glasgow.
Where other countries will come in with interim targets for absolute reductions in their emissions. And Australia's going to go in with a document which says, look at these are the technologies that are going on, let's face it, around the world. You know, most of them are not actually driven by Australia. It's important, yes, but in reducing emissions and having a target becomes actually much, much more important.
Yeah, of course, the government has been criticised for not having a middle of the century emissions reduction target. But putting that aside, though, is this the kind of plan taking to the world stage that would have a lot of overlap with some of those countries?
So hydrogen, for example, which is one of the first ones on their priority list, is actually critical on a world stage. Hydrogen is a no-brainer for us in Australia to drive forward. The second one they put forward, however, is carbon capture and storage. Countries around the world have spent a lot of money on it, and it's not going anywhere.
Some experts are more positive about another technology that features prominently in the roadmap. Annette Cowie is a principal research scientist with the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries and focuses heavily on the use of soil to capture carbon from the atmosphere, something the government also sees as part of the future.
There's two things we need to do in order to stabilise the climate of the globe. The most important thing is to reduce emissions, and most of our emissions come from fossil fuels. But there are some things that we're not going to be able to do away with altogether. And so sequestering carbon in the soil and in vegetation, in trees, for example, is going to be really important to reach that global goal of net zero. So soil carbon management is definitely an important contributor to that.
You mentioned that net zero target. The New South Wales government, among other state governments, have set that target. The federal government hasn't. But do you really need a national target, or can you just work to those state targets at the moment?
Well, the most important target is the global goal of net zero. And to reach that, we're going to need some countries to actually be net negative because some other countries aren't going to be able to reach zero. And I guess at the moment there's a lot of discussion internationally about how that could be coordinated or encouraged. But as I say, I work for the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, and in New South Wales we have a goal of net zero. So our work is aiming towards how we can achieve that in New South Wales.
Also among the government's top-tier technologies is the use of low-emissions energy sources for steel and aluminium making. While energy expert Greg Bourne does think it's possible to create iron and steel without having to rely on coal, he thinks renewable energy sources like solar will have to get a bigger mention in the plan.
Issue that I see the government is doing is they're basically waving a technology wand and basically saying, well, look, we'll develop these, and in the second half of the century, ideally, we'll become net zero. That's just too late.
That's energy expert Greg Bourne and Gavin Coote with that report. Well, one major focus of the energy roadmap is hydrogen. It's the cheap and plentiful energy source that's set to be a game changer both here in Australia and globally, likely to transform how we live and what we do. But how we reach that destination is very much in dispute. I spoke with our reporter Nick Grimm a short time ago. Nick, you've been following the hydrogen issue for a while now. Along with the ideological split that's developed, how is the industry going to develop here in Australia?
Yeah, that's right, Sally. And in this debate, you might say it comes down to a clash of colours, those who lean towards blue hydrogen and there's those who favour green hydrogen. What's the difference? Well, hydrogen is created by splitting the water molecules, so there's no shortage of that raw material for creating the stuff. But splitting the molecule also requires a large amount of energy, which in the past has been a barrier to making it a cost-effective energy source. Renewables have changed that equation, so you can create what's known as green hydrogen by using wind and solar, which is cheap and doesn't create any emissions. But you can also create blue hydrogen. Now, that's using fossil fuels like coal and gas, and provided that a technology such as carbon capture and storage is employed, and if that process can be made to work efficiently, it wouldn't create that many emissions. Now, the federal government is arguing that wind and solar are now mature technologies that no longer require government subsidies, but they also believe they're not mature enough to be relied on for creating hydrogen, which is why it's keen to support the gas industry to be both an interim energy source and in due course be used to create hydrogen as well.
Nick, it has been said that Australia has the potential to become an energy superpower. How does hydrogen help achieve that goal?
Well, Australia already has abundant coal and gas as well as renewables like wind, hydro and solar. The advantage it has over fossil fuels is it doesn't create emissions when it power stuff, and the advantage it has over other renewables is it can be easily stored and moved around and used on demand. It's great for heavy transport, for example, able to power ships, mining equipment, trucks, buses. In fact, experts say that anything that has been powered by diesel fuel in the past could be replaced by a vehicle with a hydrogen fuel cell, whereas petrol vehicles like smaller cars are gradually being replaced with electric vehicles.
In fact, you took a ride in a hydrogen car. What was that like?
Oh, it was pretty good. Very similar to my own diesel-guzzling family SUV that I own, I have to say, but a lot newer and nicer, and best of all, it was carbon-free. Now, global car manufacturers are getting ready to phase out fossil fuel engines, so these technologies are soon going to be a daily fact of life. Trouble is, some experts believe the federal government is taking the wrong route to get there. So for more on that, I spoke to Tim Buckley. He's the Director of Energy Finance Studies for Australasia with the Institute of Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
I think the government is absolutely right to be focused on hydrogen, but the technology agnostic aspect is, in my view, totally flawed. The world is moving towards decarbonisation at a million miles an hour. The world and major leading corporates, major leading financial institutions and major leading governments are focused on decarbonisation, and yet our government is absolutely focused on propping up the gas industry at every turn using taxpayer subsidies rather than focusing on the holy grail, which is green hydrogen, which I think will absolutely transform global energy markets this coming decade.
That's Tim Buckley, the Director of Energy Finance Studies for Australasia with the Institute of Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He was speaking to Nick Grimm. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Well, the pandemic could play a part in delaying the extradition of accused child sex abuser Malka Leifer to Australia. Late yesterday, a court in Israel ordered that the former principal of Melbourne's Adas Israel School should be sent back to Australia to face 74 charges of sexual abuse. But the former principal's legal team is set to appeal. Reporter Isabel Rowe spoke earlier to Australian National University International Law Professor Donald Rothwell.
Well, once extradition had been signed off by the relevant Israeli authorities, members of the Victorian Police Force would travel to Israel and arrange to take custody of Malka Leifer and return her to Australia. That would be the normal course of events, highlighting the fact that, of course, accessing Israel in the best of times can be very challenging.
Given that there is a pandemic happening, what are you expecting are the issues? If the appeal, for example, isn't allowed and she does have to come back here, can Victoria Police go to Israel on a flight as they might usually?
That's a logistical issue that we can only speculate about at the moment. I'm not aware of any examples of persons having been extradited back to Australia since the pandemic commenced. So obviously there would be just the basic logistical issues in terms of Victorian police being able to reach Israel, then being able to obtain custody of Mal Khalifa, and then being able to safely and securely return her to Australia. Now, that in itself could raise issues in terms of the availability of relevant flights. It's normally the case that in extradition matters, persons are returned on regularly scheduled commercial flights. But we know from all of the evidence at the moment that that's an extremely difficult process. So one could possibly see Mal Khalifa and her Victorian police guards hold up in a place like Dubai or Singapore, just waiting for connecting flights because of the difficulty in being able to obtain connecting flights at the moment. So there are significant logistical issues that I could foresee, certainly between now and to the end of 2020.
How do you think that her lawyers will argue against extradition using the pandemic and the situation in Australia as a reason for her not to come back here?
Well, I think the critical issue is that we know that Victoria has gone through a second wave of COVID-19, and that's resulted in significant lockdown issues and significant constraints on Victoria more generally. And I think I could see Mal Khalifa's legal team raising issues as to whether that would expose her to catching COVID-19 and raising questions about the ability of the Victorian authorities to be able to safely quarantine her upon her initial return to Australia, bearing in mind that Australia requires 14 days quarantine. But then once the quarantine period had ended, the ability to be able to safely keep her in Victorian detention facilities as she awaits trial, safe from the COVID-19.
And I suppose we don't have any precedent, so we don't know how the court in Israel might treat that, you know, whether they'll say, oh, that is perhaps a relevant concern or no, it's not a concern. There's no other case that we can look at.
And indeed, not only is that an issue for the Israeli court, but we need to bear in mind that ultimately extradition out of Israel would be a political process that needs to be signed off by the relevant Israeli government minister, and they could be swayed by these particular issues and concerns raised by not only Mal Khalifa's legal team, but also her supporters more generally throughout Israel.
Is there a potential then that she may not be able to be extradited for many months, perhaps next year, once we're over the second wave in Victoria?
Well, I think the first point is that we need to see how the Israeli legal process plays out. And already overnight, Mal Khalifa's legal team has indicated that they will seek to appeal. Now, that in itself will probably take some period of time. So it may not be until early 2021 that we have some resolution on those legal issues, by which time there might be much greater clarity in terms of the ability of someone to be safely extradited from Israel. And some of the concerns about extraditing someone to Victoria may have diminished in that intervening period.
That's Australian National University Professor Donald Rothwell speaking there to Isabel Rowe. Well, as the situation in Australia gradually improves, countries across Europe are racing to combat the feared second wave of the virus amid a surge of new infections. Later today, the British government is set to unveil further restrictions, possibly including a short-term lockdown. After dire warnings, the number of new cases there could reach up to 50,000 a day by mid-October. Barney Porter reports.
It's a debate echoing around the globe. In Athens, performance artists have protested against tightened restrictions imposed because of an increase in COVID-19 infections. We're all here to protest against these terrible measures that are killing us, says this musician. They're killing us. As artists, the umbrella covers all artists. We're dying. Their industry may indeed be dying, but it's the actual number of deaths in Greece that's prompted the reimposition of restrictions as authorities try to get a handle on the feared second wave. And it's the same across the continent. Four EU nations feature in the top 10 of countries with the highest death tolls. Spain is struggling. The virus has already killed more than 30,000 people, and Madrid's in a new lockdown. Another 31,000 are dead in France. Authorities there are opening new testing centres across Paris to reduce queues and delays. Italy's toll stands at 35,000, while the UK has the highest tally in Western Europe, with 41,000 dead and counting rapidly.
We think that the epidemic is doubling roughly every 7 days.
Patrick Vallance is the UK's chief scientific officer.
If that continues unabated and this grows doubling every 7 days, then what you see, of course, let's say there were 5,000 today, it would be 10,000 next week, 20,000 the week after, 40,000 the week after.
His punchline in the televised public briefing: if the government does nothing new, infections could rise to 50,000 a day by the middle of next month. Later today, the government is set to announce all pubs, bars, restaurants and other hospitality venues in England will have a 10 p.m. closing time. The sector will also only be able to offer table service. And if the new curve isn't flattened soon, the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, has flagged tougher measures.
We do need to make sure that everybody is sticking by the rules. And in doing so, we'll be able to, I hope, get on top of this. And if we can't, we're going to have to go for more drastic measures. And that's something we absolutely don't want to do.
This chap from London gets the challenge.
I'd certainly bring in a curfew, but I wouldn't. I think restrictions need to come into place, but I don't think we need to go back to where we were in March, April, May, June sort of thing. So, but it's a balancing act, isn't it, I guess.
And that balance is what governments around the globe are grappling with, seeing COVID as a health and an economic issue. The British government is set to unveil the details of its latest balancing act tonight.
That's Barney Porter reporting. Well, global stocks have tumbled as fresh coronavirus cases stoke jitters about a deeper economic fallout from the pandemic. That's prompted a sell-off in Australia this morning, and without a vaccine, the big question is whether there's more volatility to come. With more, I was joined earlier by our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, this isn't just about the pandemic. What are some of the other factors that have been building up in the markets?
Well, good afternoon, Sally. There is a lot to be concerned about. In addition to those second wave fears in Europe and the potential for more lockdowns, the US Congress remains deadlocked on how and when to roll out more fiscal stimulus, around another $1 trillion to support the unemployed and distressed businesses and households. Now, all of this has been complicated by the death of the US Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and congressional confirmation proceedings on President Trump's nominee to replace her, especially the Senate hearings, which will be quite intense. Now, this will dominate political debate, and it decreases the chances that Congress will pass more economic stimulus because they'll be diverted. So all of this crowded out of the agenda. The US presidential election is coming up on the 3rd of November, and depending on which poll you believe, it could be very close. So a cocktail of uncertainty, which has seen investors dump risky assets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dived 1.8% or more than 500 points earlier today. And here in Australia, the All Ords was down 0.7% in late morning trade, with the banks and the miners the hardest hit.
So, Peter, I guess the big question at the moment is, are we at the point where the economic crisis also turns into a financial crisis?
Well, not yet, Sally. We are in a deep recession after a 7% contraction in the most recent quarter. But are we heading for something worse, like the Great Depression in the 1930s? The Reserve Bank's Deputy Governor Guy Debelle faced that question this morning, but he thinks the extraordinary response from governments and central banks will prevent that dire scenario, despite the massive unemployment.
The Australian economy has come off its trough in May, so it's plausible that the worst is behind us. But as I said, the recovery from here is potentially more of a slow grind. So with any luck, we've seen the maximum point of contraction. So I think the size and rapidity of the policy response this time around has been extremely large, and it has meant that we've seen less of a contraction than we might otherwise have seen, and with any luck, avoiding the sort of outcomes that we saw back in the 30s.
That's the Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Guy Debelle, and before that, Peter Ryan. Well, that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Thanks for your company. I hope you can join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care and enjoy your afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.